And yet I think that by the end you'll see a very natural connection between what's going on in this passage and our observance of the Lord's work on our behalf through this ordinance. And we have spent a couple of weeks looking into this book as a whole. I had an introductory message a couple of weeks ago, and then last week getting into the first chapter, where you may remember we saw Moses, the author, introducing God's enslaved people and all of this, all these events and these preparations that in the plan of God were being put into place to eventually get us to the Exodus. And in fact, as we looked at that passage last week, the theme of the message was this, that an experiential knowledge of God often involves intense suffering. Remember that? The idea of God's people growing experientially in their knowledge of God is really what keeps this whole book going. But at the beginning, we are informed that in order to get there, they first have to be in a bind, in a desperate situation that they are not able to resolve for themselves. And so that intense suffering is the platform on which the Lord is going to work in their lives. And that suffering was not relieved by the end of the passage. In fact, we sort of left ourselves, we know the story, but the passage leaves the first-time reader wondering, what's going to happen? How is the Lord going to resolve this? Actually, things were much worse at the end than they were at the beginning. There was no resolution. There would need to be a lot of waiting still, and it would be quite a while before the actual Exodus. And along those lines, I share with you this statement from Alec Motyer. He says, as we look at the story of Exodus, it is a story to delight in, showing how the weak and powerless of the world overcame the strong and mighty. It is a story to horrify because of the terrible sufferings that it portrays, and as well a story to encourage because of the sure providential hand of God. It is, however, more than anything, particularly in the early stages, a story to puzzle, because the people to whom these dreadful things happened were the people of God. We are forced to ask ourselves why those whom God has chosen and to whom he had made his covenant promises should have to suffer like this. And he goes on to say this, there is something very basic in us that needs life to be logical and is restless and resentful when we cannot see adversity fulfilling some purpose. Our faith needs to mature in the face of that kind of mystery if it is to survive the days of darkness that will inevitably come upon us. In the midst of darkness, which these people were, and maybe you feel like in your own life you're going through a period of darkness, what we need is faith in a God who is overseeing and who is directing everything to the conclusion that he intends. And even when, as you read along, there is a surprise almost at every turn, and there's all of this up and down, and things don't get resolved, it seems that everything is out of control. That is even more when our faith needs to be strengthened that God is sovereign over these events. That, in fact, is what we're going to be seeing as we go into chapter 2 of Exodus, and the general title of the message this morning is The Hand of God in the Unexpected. These are, of course, the verses in this chapter. They are, of course, the story of Moses coming on the scene and some of the initial incidents in his life, all of which really are unexpected, a lot of which at the moment would not have made a lot of sense. And apart from reading the entire book of Exodus, they really would seem like a total waste of time and an indication that things were flying out of control. But where is the hand of God in these unexpected events? And like we have started doing with these studies, we're going to walk through the passage. I'm going to highlight a few themes, the main ideas in each section, a few thoughts to develop that and then come to the actual theme of the passage and its application more toward the end of our time together. So what do we see as we consider, first of all, in verses 1 to 10, we see an unexpected beginning. This is where we read about the birth of Moses under unusual circumstances. An unexpected beginning. And we want to see the fingerprints of God directing and moving all of these things, even though going through it, if you had been experiencing this in real time, you would not have seen it. We have the advantage of looking at it from the standpoint of all of these fingerprints of God, and we know where the story is going. But what was involved in this unexpected beginning? Look with me at verse 1. It says, "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman." And what I want to highlight there is the tribe from which this family came that Moses was born into. It is the tribe of Levi. Do you know what the last specific thing that was said about the tribe of Levi in the Pentateuch? It was not very complimentary. It was not very positive at all. And I want to read for you from Genesis 49. These are the deathbed blessings and prophecies of Jacob about his sons and of the people that would come from those sons. Here is what he said in Genesis 49, verses 5 to 7. "Simeon," that's one of the boys, "and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel." What if your dad was on his deathbed, and he was giving a little message to each of the children, and all he can think of to say about you is, "Cursed be your anger. You killed innocent people. What a blot on our family name." That was Levi. And what is he talking about? He's talking about the incident that is recorded in Genesis 34 at the city of Shechem, where one of their sisters, Dinah, had been basically kidnapped and then raped by a man from that city. And in their desire for vengeance, they tricked the men of the city to be circumcised. And in their time of healing and weakness, they went in and they wiped them all out and slaughtered the men of an entire city and plundered their belongings and their families. And it was headed up, that effort, by Simeon and Levi. And no doubt, that is what would be most remembered about them in the book of Genesis. And then as Jacob finishes up, what does he say is going to happen as a result? He says at the end of verse 7, "I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." The idea is that part of the judgment of God is that these two tribes are not going to have their own independent land or property where they're going to be settled. Somehow, they're going to be subsumed into the broader nation and not have, as a blessing of God, the same kind of tribal identity as the other tribes did. Levi was one of those men. And as we continue in the passage today, we find that Moses also has a vengeful response towards somebody that leads to that individual's death. In other words, it seems like he is sort of continuing the tradition of Levi, taking matters into his own hands, acting in rage, and just wiping somebody out if you find yourself in opposition to that person, even if you may have good cause, just over the top, overreaction that leads to somebody's death. And so in a way, that's not surprising because that's the last thing you read about Levi. But the prophecy had been that they were going to be scattered among the other tribes. And it actually happened differently for them than it happened for the tribe of Simeon. Here, this tribe of Levi that had such a bad reputation. Reading later in the Pentateuch, you find that by the courage of one of them, they're able to recover something of a reputation of using that energy actually as instruments of God's judgment in an appropriate way. And then God, coming out of that, says, I have chosen this tribe to be my priests and to be those that take care of and manage the worship of Yahweh and the tabernacle that is to be built. These people with that kind of reputation ended up being the ones entrusted with the regular offerings of the sacrifices. They ended up being the ones with the responsibility of teaching the law to the rest of Israel. What a stroke of the grace of God that that was the tribe he chose. And what an interesting fact that the one who would actually initiate the sacrificial system and give the law to begin with, he happens to be from this tribe of Levi. God connects him in a way with that background, but begins a process through which he is going to pull him out of that and is going to make him an instrument of blessing to the entire nation. And that's like the first thing you read about Moses. That is verse 1. Verse 2. That was his family, and then we read about his birth. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. Now, this may seem like a routine report of what happens when people get married and the woman gets pregnant and they have a child. But if you remember, again, the Pentateuch, this is the book of Exodus, I pointed out before, is just the next installment of the covenant history that started in Genesis. The whole idea, the whole theme of people having children is hugely significant for the theme of Genesis. In fact, I remember when I preached through that book, sometimes I would say, here's what Genesis is about. Genesis is about women having babies. The whole book is structured according to genealogies. The whole plot is the outworking of the promise about a seed of the woman, and more specifically about the growth of the seed of Abraham. And it's a big, long story about a handful of women, the wives of the patriarchs, every one of which was barren. And yet God worked mightily so that those women could have children, and it was through them that eventually these tribes came into the world. And by this point, those descendants of those barren women were on the order of 2.5 million people. So that the idea of giving of birth and children coming into this world is a part of the redemptive plan of God. This is foundational to what the Lord is doing. And as you read the book of Genesis, some form of that expression, she conceived and bore a son, occurs 15 times. And guess what is the very last time that that expression occurs? It's right here in the verse that we are looking at. It's almost as though the birth of Moses up to this point in history is the climactic birth, because through him, something so astounding is going to happen, where all those people that have been born are going to be taken out of Egypt and are going to be formed into a nation of God on the earth. So it may seem like a little thing, but in the context of the Pentateuch, I believe you're supposed to be connecting it to all of these other redemptive sort of births that have taken place. And in addition to that indication of God working to keep his promises through the birth of children, you also have, right alongside it, an emphasis on the faith and the courage of the individuals involved, the human side of it. It says that when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. We know from another passage that this woman's name was Jochebed. And she resisted that that murderous decree of Pharaoh just as long as she could and had the same spirit and response that the midwives of Israel had in the passage that we looked at last week. She would not go along with this plan for wiping out the male descendants of Abraham. And it's helpful that for some of these incidents in this chapter, we actually have some New Testament commentary that's giving us God's perspective on how he viewed that. So for this point, Hebrews 11:23 says this, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict." With the idea of him being beautiful or attractive, there's just this natural connection, this natural affection that a mother has for a son, but it is more than that. It is an unwillingness to go along with governmental decrees that are entirely contrary to the will of God. This woman was putting up resistance. And then verse 3 says, when she could hide him no longer, she comes up with another strategy to try to protect. And you can imagine why she couldn't do that for more than about 3 months. In terms of how difficult it is to hide a baby and keep him quiet and sort of suppress all the excitement that goes along with that. Here is her strategy. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. Actually, you could argue that technically she was obeying Pharaoh's command. Because Pharaoh had said, they need to be thrown in the Nile. And she said, okay, you didn't say I had to leave him without any assistance. We'll throw him in the Nile in a little ship. And there may have been more that she had in mind with that. We're not even sure that she just put him there and hoped for the best and just kind of left it at that. Or that she just planned to leave him there indefinitely. It may be that this went on for a time where during the daylight hours when it was most likely that the Egyptians would come looking for baby, she would hide him in the river at that time and then bring him back home for the evening. One possibility. And it also says that she placed this among the reeds by the riverbank. In other words, she didn't throw him out into the open water just to sail along and hope he makes it somewhere safely. It's a highly vegetated area where it would have helped to keep it in certain, keep the little chest in certain parameters where they could be supervised and prevented from drifting off. And in fact, when you think about the fact that people would go down there, ladies would go down and wash clothes for their family and bathe and so forth, this wasn't just like letting him go unattended. In fact, she may have even gone to a particular area where she knew that Pharaoh's daughter bathed, hoping that this other woman, from a female standpoint, loving children, hoping that there would be some kind of compassionate response. We're not totally sure about those details. What I do want to point out is that the word basket might give you the wrong impression. That kind of brings to my mind a picnic basket or something like that. But here again, that word has been used earlier in the Pentateuch. Do you know when it was used? It's actually the same word. It only shows up one other time. In the story of Noah for the ark that he built for the protection of his family through the flood. And in fact, that ark was also sealed with pitch to keep the water out. And I don't think that connection is by mistake. It really does invite comparison between Noah and Moses and their place in the plan of God. Both of them were deliverers. Both of them, their lives were marked by just courageous faith and obedience. Both of them suffered great trials as a part of their calling, and both of them were key to the continuation of the redemptive program of God. Now, Moses would not have been aware about that at this time, and his family probably wasn't thinking about it either. But we want to read in the broader context And that comparison, I believe, is supposed to get the reader to recognize this isn't just some random birth and some woman just trying to figure something out to save her son. Something more is going on here. The hand of God is somehow involved in these unusual circumstances. Let's read what happens next in verse 4. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside the river. When she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child. And behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. That passage is just dripping with irony. Remember, Pharaoh, his strategy was, we got to get rid of the men, because they would be the soldiers that might try to overthrow us. And we take the women and we take them as wives and sort of mix together the two ethnicities so that, in effect, they become Egyptians. So he is mostly afraid of the men, as though the men are the ones that are really the threat. The women we can manage and deal with. Humanly speaking, who are the heroes in this story? It is his own daughter that steps up to protect Moses. And his own daughter ends up undermining his entire plan. And it was through as well the role that two other women played, and that is Moses' mother and his sister. On top of that, not only is Moses' life saved, but his mother ends up making money off the deal. You know, later on it'll say that as people of Israel were leaving Egypt, they plundered the Egyptians. And the Egyptians were like, "Just get out of here already. Just take whatever you want." Well, here that process is already starting. Moses' mother is the first example of plundering the Egyptians. And don't forget the connection with water that I pointed out last time. Pharaoh had been trying to use the water of the Nile to destroy Israel. Eventually, it would be the water of the Red Sea that would destroy his army. And here, the water of the Nile actually becomes the means by which Israel's deliverer is spared so that he could eventually carry out his role. And we come to the last verse of this section, verse 10. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." In other words, that whole water business is embedded right in his name. Now, there is a real difficulty the scholars have in explaining exactly the connection between the spelling of his name and the meaning. There seems to be more of a pun that is going on here. Part of the problem is, of course, that Moses is a Hebrew name, and the daughter of Pharaoh would have spoken Egyptian, though maybe she knew some Hebrew as well. And if you're looking for a short explanation of all the complicated theories, I'll just read to you the note that you will find in the ESV Study Bible. It's probably as good as any. They say, quote, "In Hebrew, the name sounds like the verb mashah, to draw out. The name may also be related to the common Egyptian word for son, S-O-N. And that ought to ring a bell, because if you know some of the names of the pharaohs, the same combination of letters, M-S, is in there, like Tutmos, M-O-S-E. It's the same combination, particularly the consonants. And he goes on to say, since Pharaoh's daughter clearly knows that Moses is a Hebrew child, it is possible she chose the name for both its Hebrew, drawn out of water, and Egyptian son senses. The irony of such a dual reference would be that her action not only prefigures, but is also part of the means that God uses to draw Israel as his son out of Egypt. In other words, all of this comes into play in the later events of the book. Moses is the one that God uses to draw out the people of Israel, God's son, out of Egypt. And notice that the authors of that statement are highlighting that as yet another example of irony. Now, you might wonder how it was that Pharaoh's daughter could get away with this. And again, there are questions here that we're not able to answer because the text doesn't. But we do know this, that these ancient Near Eastern kings had typically many wives and multiple grandchildren. Children, grandchildren that are born through those alliances. Those alliances were often not romantic kinds of relationships, at least not to start out with. They were ways by which a political treaty was sealed. And so if you're going to make an agreement with another country, one of the ways that you can kind of firm that up so that you hopefully will prevent conflict in the future is to marry the daughter of the king. And if something goes wrong, you're really in a tough situation. You're really going to do both sides. You're going to do everything they can to preserve that because you don't want to end up fighting in a battle against somebody who's related to you, one of your in-laws. And so these kings would end up having all kinds of connections with different tribes and different nations arranged through marriage on top of however many other women that they might choose to have. The point is that I don't know that Pharaoh kept track of all the nuances of everybody in his family. It's not like they all lived in one household as one big happy family. This is a very complicated dynamic. But it does seem hard to believe that he would be oblivious for the entirety of the upbringing of Moses. I don't know how it all worked, but I did remember as I was thinking about this some of the things that we observed in the book of Esther, which was another story that was very similar in its theme to what we're reading here. And you may remember that in that story of Esther, even though the king was the one formally in charge and making the decisions and the decrees and so forth, in reality, he was the one that was least in charge. And he ends up looking like quite a fool on several occasions. Everything just sort of happened to him, caused by other characters, and he's just kind of stuck in the middle. And that eventually is also going to be the picture of Pharaoh, though he tries to exert himself and he hardens his heart and he gets very aggressive. In the end, he really is not the ultimate actor in the story. However that all worked, what this meant for Moses is that he grew up in the Pharaoh, in the court of one of the highest rulers of the entire ancient Near East, and as a result of that, he would have received a world-class education. And he would have been instructed by the most accomplished teachers of the day in languages and literature and law and politics. And isn't it interesting that the one who would end up being the lawgiver and the leader, the sort of king figure for the people of Israel, ended up with all of that preparation, all of that education in his background? In other words, there are a lot of unexpected and kind of mysterious things here, but the hand of God is orchestrating all of these things. This unexpected beginning is one big and complex witness to the sovereign hand of God ruling over the affairs of men to do what he desires to do. And it creates the expectation that Moses is going to play a big role in solving the problems of chapter 1. And yet things quickly turn in a bad direction for him. And so we come to the next set of verses and talk about an unexpected failure on his part. An unexpected failure where you would have thought, given all that he did know and his knowledge of the nuances of how the king operated, that he might have approached this situation in a bit wiser way, we are a bit thrown off when we read what happens next. Verse 11. One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Clearly, Moses has made a huge and life-altering mistake. And we'll deal with that, but before we do that, I think we need to give him some kind of recognition, acknowledging that at least his motives were right. In this moment, as he saw one of his countrymen being abused by an Egyptian, who did he side with? He was a member of Pharaoh's family and court. He was actually taking a risk to side with the Hebrew. And yet he chose to affiliate himself with his own countrymen rather than disdaining him and doing the safe thing. In fact, verse 11 says, he looked on their burdens. And if you go down to the end of the chapter, a passage I plan to come to the next time we're in this chapter, and you see verse 25, that the comment there is, God saw the people of Israel. That's a very similar expression, same verb. God saw the people in their need, and so he stepped in to deliver them. Moses was also seeing, taking note of their burdens, looking on their suffering, and his heart goes out to them as well. In other words, he actually shares the heart of God as far as the people of Israel are concerned. And so that is a positive thing that we want to keep in mind, particularly as we read on. In fact, what does Hebrews chapter 11 say about him? Verse 24, by faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. If you can imagine the kind of hedonistic and carefree life that Moses could have enjoyed. But it says he rejected the fleeting pleasures of sin by just diving into the Egyptian court, and he chose rather to be mistreated with God's people. In fact, it says he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. And when Stephen, over there in the book of Acts, is preaching his final sermon, he also mentions this in Acts 7, starting at verse 23. He says about Moses, when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. In other words, somehow Moses already in this early moment had a sense. The kind of things that have happened to me don't just happen. This is an indication that God is raising me up, and I can see the evidence of that, and I want to take a step in that direction. And the other Hebrews did not get it. They did not appreciate it. So, Moses had been picking up on the very thing that we have been observing in this passage, that his unusual circumstances were an indication that the Lord's hand was on him as the deliverer. But even though his motives were right, clearly his method was not. He was looking at a legitimate problem that needed to be addressed, but he responded in anger and he overreacted. And in the process, guess what? He became guilty of a sin that he himself later, in writing Genesis and the books of the law, would say is a capital offense according to God. And we have questions about that. just like we do about David and why the Lord didn't insist on the letter of the law in his case. The Lord is free to make exceptions according to his will. In fact, aren't we all in the same position ultimately that we deserve death and the Lord has been gracious to us? And the Lord showed an extra measure of grace to Moses at this early stage in his life, sparing him. And yet I would imagine that throughout his life, this failure hung heavy on him and kept him aware of his frailty. Perhaps it also kept him in later situations from overreacting when the temptation was there, though we know that there are passages that indicate this continued to be a struggle for him. There's a lesson for us here, and it's not the bigger application that I'm going to get to in just a moment, but we certainly learned from this that good intentions are not enough. It is not just a matter of having a right goal. We have to ask exactly how does God want me to address the problems before me, and also when. Some of this was about the timing. When we react and when we act prematurely, it can have devastating effects on other people as well as on the course of our own lives. I think that is there for us to take away, but I don't want to focus on it so much that we miss how it was that the Lord himself, in grace, was acting even through Moses' sin. This unexpected failure became a tool in the hand of God to shape him into the kind of service that was needed for the problem before him. And that brings us to the final part of this passage. As we look at verses 16 to 22, an unexpected detour in his life. Have you ever gotten detoured from some trip that you are making, trying to get to a destination, and there's construction or some incident you have to take the long way around? It is frustrating. It feels like it's a waste of time. It's not what you had planned on, and it has spillover effects on other things that you intended to do. Well, this is what ends up happening in his life. Verse 16. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and I assume this wasn't like the next day, but it says, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. When we read this, we want to realize that Moses was not entirely giving up his heritage. And that's because the Midianites were actually descendants of Abraham, just like he was. They came not through Sarah, but through a woman by the name of Keturah that was a later wife of Abraham. And in fact, the point is made here that Reuel was a priest of Midian. That might indicate that going back to the Abrahamic heritage, he was actually a believer in the one true and living God. And that from the position as a priest, before the priesthood was formally set up in Israel, this man would have been a source of truth and a source of encouragement for Moses. In fact, later on in the Pentateuch, there are some indications that he at least had become a believer in the Lord. But I want you to notice some more of the irony here. What was the context in which these things took place? Again, there is water involved. Not the water of a lake or the water of an ocean, but the water in a well that becomes the specific incident by which Moses is led to a woman that he marries. Has that ever happened before? Again, remember the book of Genesis. Water at a well was key in both Isaac and Jacob finding their wives. In fact, Jacob's situation was very much like this one, in that he stepped in to give water to a shepherdess who, unbeknownst to him, was a relative and whom he ended up marrying. Again, as we've seen in other cases here in the plan of God, history is like echoing itself. Be looking for those patterns indicative of the involvement of God as you read these Old Testament stories. And then what happens in verse 22? A baby is born. Not exactly the same terminology of conception, but it does say she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. Here is another little token that God has not forgotten him, and the birth of a child is significant against the backdrop of the seed promise of the covenant with Abraham. Here is another installment of that in the birth of this child. And yet, notice the name that Moses gives him. There's a fascinating study you can do just tracing out the different children that are born in Genesis and the names that are given to each one as an explanation for actually what's going on in the book of Genesis as a whole. In this case, he says Gershom because I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. The phrase Gershom means a sojourner or an alien there, as in this other land. He viewed himself as being in exile during this period. In fact, in Acts chapter 7, when Stephen is talking about this part of his life, he says that Moses was an exile. Moses recognizes, I don't belong here. This is not my land. And it seems to be he's saying that with a broken heart. He's disappointed. He is demoralized by where he has ended up. He feels like his life did take a major detour, that these great plans he thought God had for him had not panned out. The Lord had somehow failed. There doesn't seem to be much hope to get back on track. I'm sort of stuck here in this detour. And yet, he does say, I'm a sojourner. And that implies that this is not a permanent condition or the real nature of things. And there has been so much in this passage about how the Lord behind the scenes has been orchestrating to get Moses to be who he needs to be and where he needs to be that the reader is encouraged to just keep going in the passage and you will find how the Lord is going to get him out of the exile period and back on track. In fact, speaking of exile, the entire nation of Israel. The word sojourner, alien, would be a description for them for over 400 years at this point. And God was about to raise him up to get them to where they belonged out of their period of exile. Now, there's still a lot that has to happen before that will become a reality. And once again, this story just kind of ends there. The next verse moves back over to Egypt, and so we're going to stop here today, and we're going to try to pull together what we have seen. There's actually a theological word that I really haven't used in the outline yet, but that captures all of these ironies and all these unexpected developments. It is the word providence. The invisible hand of God shaping and directing events. And that is what I would want to use to capture the theme of this chapter. It is that God's providence prepares his servants for his work. That is one way to summarize what we have considered. And I want us to take away three observations of how God was using this to prepare Moses and how he works often in our lives as well. First of all, I would suggest that God's providence prepares us by protecting us from harm and by placing us in conducive circumstances. That is, in circumstances that will be used to get us to where we need to be and to prepare us for what we need to do in the plan of God. God's providence prepares us by protecting us from harm and by placing us in conducive circumstances. Now, I think we need to be careful whenever we talk about God's providence and look at these stories as kind of a window into how God works, because I recognize that God's very individual and no one's life is like a template for everybody's life. And some people sort of over-spiritualize things that happen to them and try to find a divine purpose in every last little thing and come up with this sort of very fleshed-out plan of what the Lord is doing. Often, you cannot figure this out. And often, when you do, it's not till much later that it all starts to click. But I think over time, as we observe the big picture of our life experience, we are often able to detect how the Lord has orchestrated things to get us to exactly where we need to be. And I couldn't help but think about the younger people in our congregation, because this is talking about largely Moses in his childhood and youth, and how the Lord, being sovereign over a young person's life in terms of the circumstances in which you were born and reared, has to be for a reason. It is not by mistake that the young people in this church belong to the families that they belong to. It is not by mistake that they have grown up with the gospel. It is not by mistake that they have or are receiving a godly, Bible-based education. And one of the takeaways from this, all that you have received in terms of education, upbringing, example, as you look at a life like Moses, appreciate God is intending for you to use this. Not to get to 21 or whatever and move out of your house and say, well, that was interesting. Now I need to just figure out what I'm going to do with my life. Like I'm just starting over from scratch. And that was just kind of something I had to go through. And doesn't really matter as far as my future going forward. Surely God has a purpose for why he puts you in the environment that he does. Number two, God's providence as well prepares us by overruling our sin and using it to redirect us. Remember that Moses deserved to be executed. But instead of taking that approach, the Lord used his sin to actually deal with him as a further preparation for the next phases of his life. And folks, we would have to confess that the Lord is so merciful to us as well. It's easy to look at Moses' life and think about all the stupid things he may have done as a young person. I can think of some stupid things I did as a young person that I don't want anybody to know. But I would confess, if that was the full of my story, I would be as far away from this pulpit as I could possibly be. The Lord is so gracious and is so merciful. He doesn't give us what our sins deserve. And even the chastening he does give us becomes a tool through which he is moving us toward greater effectiveness. And that leads me to this last thought as we walk away from Moses sitting out there in the desert. God's providence prepares us by humbling us and by maturing us. Even when we're there because of the consequence of our own sin, that becomes just another tool. God's very creative. God can use whatever happens, whatever we might choose to do, to turn it around and move things forward toward his goal. You realize that Moses spent a whole third of his life in this desert. Imagine your life being on hold and you feeling like, this doesn't amount to anything, all my dreams are dashed. What am I accomplishing for a third of your life? I'm sure there was a lot of confusion and discouragement. All of his royal training seemed to be wasted on a bunch of dumb sheep in the desert. But this was not a waste in the plan of God. And it is making the point that education and life experiences and skills and even courage are not all that is needed to accomplish the purpose of God for our lives. Even more foundational are things like humility and a deference to the Lord, a reliance upon Him for direction, for timing, for power. Those were the kinds of lessons that Moses would have been learning in the wilderness, and they are also the lessons that he intends to teach us through the wilderness experiences of our own lives. That may be the Lord's word for somebody here if you feel like your life is sort of on hold. Actually, it feels like all of our lives have been on hold for about 3 years. But beyond that, because of other circumstances, whether it's your family or your job or your ministry or your relationships, you feel like you're kind of stuck and not a whole lot is happening. This story is urging us to submit to the lessons that God desires to teach us through those dry times in His providence. Now, you might say, what in the world does all that have to do with the Lord's Supper? Well, here's my transition. God's providence as well prepared our Savior for His own central part in the plan of redemption. And not that Moses and Christ are exact parallels, but they are parallels in many ways. And in a number of ways, even the early life of Jesus reflects what happened to Moses. Remember what happened in Matthew 2? And the wise men come looking for the king, and Herod is threatened, and he can't find them, and so he says, let's kill all of the male children, 2 years old and under. And the Lord takes baby Jesus, Joseph and Mary, down to Egypt, and the comment is made, rise and take the child, and so forth. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. And people wonder, what's the connection there? That's actually a verse from Hosea chapter 11. I think the connection is this. In the case of Moses, you have Moses leaving Egypt to a place of protection that was needed at the time. And so he left Egypt, and that was a part of the Lord setting up to eventually take Egypt, take Israel out of Egypt altogether. In the case of Jesus, the Pharaoh figure is actually Herod. And what corresponds to Egypt is actually Judah and Jerusalem. And this verse is quoted when they're going down to Egypt, getting away from that, meaning the really dangerous, ungodly place that's a threat is actually Judah and Jerusalem. Herod is Pharaoh. Jesus needs to be protected. Out of Egypt, I called my son, actually, ironically, to Egypt to protect him during those vulnerable days. And it's like the same experience of Moses, just in the opposite direction because of the connection between Herod and Pharaoh. And we see all of these things beautifully tying into the story of Jesus. Irony all over the place here. The real Egypt becomes the place of protection from the Pharaoh figure who sits on the throne of Judah, the symbolic Egypt. And as surely as God brought Moses back to Egypt and through him got his people out of there, he would also bring out Jesus from that same country, and through him he would accomplish the ultimate exodus for us. I think I mentioned earlier that the death of Jesus is described as a kind of an exodus through which he broke the bondage of sin and death on our behalf. And that is what we celebrate as we come to this ordinance today. So let us mark and celebrate the providence of God, not only in the life of Moses, but in the life of our Savior. I'd like to ask our men to come and prepare the elements of the table for us.